From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. When you think of repressive countries, Russia, Venezuela, and China might come to mind. But there is one country that may be worse than all of them, Eritrea. The tiny African nation located on the continent's northeastern coast, bordering Ethiopia, Sudan, and Djibouti, is ranked dead last out of 180 countries on Reporters Without Borders' World Press Freedom Index. All privately owned media outlets were shuttered more than a decade ago, when some of the country's best-known journalists were locked away in a makeshift prison of shipping containers in a searing desert. But you don't have to be a journalist to run into trouble with the Eritrean government. The nation of 6 million has as many as 10,000 political prisoners. They include people practicing banned religions, such as evangelical Christianity, people caught trying to flee the country, and those who speak out against President Isaias Afwerki's authoritarian regime. Afwerki once reportedly said, quote, "Those who think there will be democracy in this country can think so in another world." Another world might be what many Eritreans are wishing for. Every citizen over age 18 faces mandatory conscription into the army, conscription that can last indefinitely. According to the World Bank's most recent estimate, nearly 40% of children under 5 are malnourished in a country that has kicked out most foreign aid organizations. Eritrea even struggles to field an international soccer team. More than 50 of its players have defected over the past 6 years. Thousands of ordinary people try and flee every month and risk being shot on sight by their country's own border guards. The United Nations Campaign for Human Rights said there are more than 100,000 refugees in Sudan right now, and more Eritreans are trying to cross the Mediterranean into Europe. Even then, many say they do not feel entirely safe from Afwerki's men. Today on Global Journalist, a look at Eritrea, a place some call the North Korea of Africa. Joining us from Amsterdam, Leslie Lefkow, the Deputy Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. From Nairobi, Kenya, Tom Rhodes, the East Africa Representative for the Committee to Protect Journalists. And from Iowa City, Iowa, Ambassador Ron McMullen. He was ambassador to Eritrea from 2007 to 2010 and now teaches at the University of Iowa. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Ambassador McMullen, you were there several years ago and spent 3 years living in the capital, Asmara. Give our listeners just a sense of what it's like to be in Eritrea, what the country is like.
Asmara is, in many respects, a delightful city to live in. It's at 7,700 feet above sea level. It's cool and sunny. The downtown area is a collection of old Italian modernist buildings. The streets are lined with palm trees. The Eritrean people are wonderful, very friendly, and proud of their country and their history. So, in many respects, Asmara is a beautiful, pleasant place to live in terms of its architecture, its demography, its setting, its climate, etc. But it's very, very repressed, and the government of President Isaias is highly centralized and very authoritarian and attempts to control all aspects of life.
Leslie Lefkow in the Netherlands. Eritrea has been in the news a bit recently because so many of the migrants that are trying to cross the Sahara, trying to cross the Mediterranean, do originate in Eritrea. Now, there are many poor countries in Africa. Why is it that so many people from Eritrea specifically are fleeing?
Well, I think one reason is the general repression that Ambassador McMullen described, which does affect most aspects of life. But there's one specific factor which is driving many of the young men in particular to flee, and that's the indefinite military conscription and national service. So the government has had for some years now a policy of 18 months of national service or military service.
So you're basically drafted as soon as you finish high school.
Right. But in practice, the service actually is indefinite. So people don't leave generally for sometimes decades once they've actually been conscripted. And the pay is paltry. It's not enough to live on. It's not enough to support a family. And when you are a member of the military or doing national service, you are vulnerable to very serious abuses, very harsh discipline and punishments for minor infractions. So this is the main reason why many, many young people are fleeing. And this is what we hear from a lot of the people who have fled either in North Africa or in Europe once they arrive.
Tom Rhodes, tell us just a bit about how the media functions in Eritrea. How do people get their information? How do foreign reporters get their information about this country?
Well, I suppose the simple answer is they don't. It's as you mentioned in the introduction, it's completely state controlled. The last foreign correspondent left in 2007, and there hasn't been any back since then. And this is, I guess, one reason why, I mean, it's a bit of a misnomer, but one reason why Eritrea is often compared to North Korea, because there's such a vacuum of information that's coming out of the country, both for foreigners and the locals. One thing that we contend with a lot, actually, is Eritrean journalists fleeing the country, and it's rather ironic that all of them are state journalists.
So these are people who work for the government, who work for government media outlets, and then they're fleeing the government itself.
Exactly. And, of course, this belies the question, you know, what would prompt such levels to flee the country, given this, the fact that they work within the state apparatus.
Ambassador McMullen, you know, Tom Rhodes just described a place where it's very difficult to get information. What kind of access did you have as a foreign diplomat in Eritrea? How was it for you to obtain information about what was happening in the country?
We were restricted in a number of ways, including travel. You had to request permission to travel more than 15 miles out of the capital 10 days in advance, or you had to receive the written permission to travel. I put in 65 travel requests during my time as ambassador there, and I received 14. So the government controls travel. It also attempts to control access to diplomats. For example, at one point we were having a public lecture series in an auditorium. The Ministry of Communications prohibited us from having one evening's lecture, actually physically locked the gates shut on the auditorium.
Well, what was this lecture about, some particularly sensitive topic?
It was about anthropology. And how Eritrea had been the bridge for early Homo sapiens to go from Africa to across the Red Sea. So,
and this type of discussion, the government didn't want you to have this type of discussion.
That's right. And so there was actually, they were trying to take the names of all of the, 150 Eritreans who were attending this lecture. They roughed up one of my junior officers, an American Foreign Service officer. And at the end, we moved this lecture into the patio of the embassy and continued. But clearly, the Ministry of Communications didn't want 150 Eritreans to listen to this lecture. We had access. The Eritrean people looked at America as a hope for a better life, both internally and if they could flee Eritrea. So we had lots of Eritreans who were willing to talk with us. Ministers of the government came to my house for dinner. We had regular discussions with the president's political and economic advisors. So we had relatively good access, but we really had bad relations. I mean, they closed down the defense attaché's office. The Peace Corps had been closed. USAID kicked out. They seized or detained diplomatic pouches in contravention of the Vienna Convention. And so it was really a tough place to be an American diplomat. 48 of our Eritrean employees had been arrested from 2001 to 2010. Some had been arrested for many years. Others were arrested for several weeks or months and kept in deplorable conditions bordering on torture. So it was really tough. Every day was a challenge. And we looked for small victories in keeping the embassy open and maintaining a platform of American values, talking about human rights and democratization and trying to promote regional stability in a very volatile part of the world.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at the repressive African nation of Eritrea and how journalists and people there are surviving under a harsh dictator. Our guest this week from Amsterdam in the Netherlands, Leslie Lefkow, the Deputy Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. From Nairobi, Kenya, Tom Rhodes, the East Africa Representative for the Committee to Protect Journalists. And from Iowa City, Iowa, Ron McMullen, the former U.S. Ambassador to Eritrea from 2007 to 2010. He now teaches at the University of Iowa. A reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read in-depth articles on international affairs and free press issues, and download past episodes from our archive. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. Leslie Lefkow, recently the United Nations Human Rights Commission conducted a very extensive investigation into the human rights situation in Eritrea and concluded that the government may be committing crimes against humanity against its own people. What were one or two of some of the key findings from that report?
Well, one of the findings was that, you know, thousands of people have been arbitrarily arrested and detained and mistreated, sometimes tortured in detention. I mean, this is a pattern of abuse that has been long known. But I think that the Commission of Inquiry report, of course, you know, which is a 500-page report that was months in the making, gives a new level of credibility to the patterns of human rights abuses that have been documented up to date. I mean, the other issue that the commission did look into was the issue of military conscription, indefinite military conscription, and the abuses related to that, some of which I mentioned, but also, for example, for women serving, sexual violence is a threat for many women, sometimes from their commander, sometimes from other recruits, and that's another major problem that was mentioned in the report.
And I understand that there is also, Eritrea is very closed, but there are one or two foreign-owned mines in Eritrea, and there have been accusations that there is forced labor, almost slave labor, taking place in some of those mines.
I mean, this, again, it links back to the sort of indefinite national service, because many of the conscripts who are used both at the Nevsun mine in particular, which where there's been quite some documentation of forced labor being used in the construction phase.
This is a gold mine operated by a Canadian company, is that right?
Exactly. But that's, you know, that's one case, but there's actually a much broader pattern of forced labor being used, often national service conscripts for infrastructure projects, often even for private construction projects, building homes, for example, for high-level officials or commanders. So it's a broad and enormous problem, actually.
And Tom Rhodes in Nairobi, I want to take you back to 2001, and this is just after the end of the war between Ethiopia and Eritrea. They fought a two-year border war from 1998 to 2000, and there was a big roundup of journalists at that time after the end of the war, and there were 11, as I understand it, prominent reporters who were sort of quote-unquote forcibly disappeared. What do we know about what happened to these 11?
Yeah, I mean, this 2001 really is the sort of the real starting point of the crackdown on the press. And it's a very sad moment because, you know, when you talk to some of those who managed to escape getting imprisoned, some of them are now in Canada, some are in the States, you can see how that, you know, it was a fledgling independent press that was trying to take off and started to challenge, you know, major national issues such as why the Constitution hadn't been promulgated yet. But they were all summarily arrested and imprisoned. And we've been trying to keep track of those in jail since, as you say, 11 journalists. It's hard to determine. We can only say roughly two cases, unfortunately, have passed away while in prison during that time. But there are others, and it's always our worry that they may have also passed away while in detention in this incommunicado fashion.
So you've confirmed that two of the journalists who were arrested then have died while they were in detention. There may be as many as nine who are still alive.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, it may be less.
You know? Well, Ambassador McMullen, I wanted to turn this back to you as well. We talked about this time period in 2001 where the press faced a lot of repression. This seems to have been kind of a departure point for Eritrea. And as I understand it, you know, Eritrea's outlook was not always sort of so authoritarian and repressive. Correct me if I'm wrong. I believe President Bill Clinton actually referred to President Afewerki as sort of a new generation of African leaders back in the 1990s as, you know, one of a group of leaders who would take the continent forward with respect to democracy and human rights and take it forward economically.
It was actually Susan Rice who said that. And yes, there was some promise. I mean, President Isaias looked like a modernizing, rational new leader on the continent. And there was some hope that Eritrea would be able to recover from 30 years of its independence war. But after this horrible World War I style border war with Ethiopia, Eritrea's view of itself changed from invincible sort of God's chosen land to, my goodness, we almost lost that war and everything that we fought for. So in 2001, there were grumbles about Isaias. He hadn't promulgated the Constitution. There were no elections. Some thought the war was badly managed from his perspective. And so there were voices calling for change and reform and more transparency. And the ruling party, the Popular Front for Democracy and Justice, was the only legal party. And young journalists were calling for change. And the president realized he was in a vulnerable situation. And rather than being a reformist, reverted to what he had learned as a young political commissar trainee in China during Mao's Cultural Revolution in 1967, and that is close down voices of dissent, close down institutions that could propose change or reform, and tighten and centralize the party and state's control of every aspect of society. And that's the route he chose to take in 2001 because of the threat to his position after this very bloody war with Ethiopia. Over a town called Badme, a disputed border town that a border commission found actually belongs to Eritrea. Ethiopia still occupies it. And so many Eritreans feel that the international community has abandoned them, even in their rightful cause to reassert its control over Badme.
So in other words, there was an international border commission that was established after this war was fought. It said this little town that the war was fought over actually did belong to Eritrea, but Ethiopia has refused to abide by that decision, and that's generated a lot of bad feeling on the part of
yes,
the Eritreans then.
Exactly right.
Well, Leslie Lefkow, let me ask you, because you had mentioned earlier that one sort of different or unusual aspect of Eritrea is this issue of indefinite conscription. And yet, I think, as I understand it, there's also another intriguing aspect of the Eritrean regime, and that's how effective its control is of the Eritrean diaspora, of Eritreans who live overseas. Could you tell us just a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly Eritreans in the diaspora, Eritreans who leave, certainly have a degree of fear that is almost unique among diaspora populations. The fear of the Eritrean government's tentacles, its surveillance, its security agents being present in countries in the region and in Europe and elsewhere, spying on them, watching them, that fear runs very deep. And to some extent, it's justified. We know, for example, that particularly in the region, Eritreans who flee, for example, to neighboring countries or to Kenya or elsewhere are often being watched. There have been cases where Eritreans have been arrested and or disappeared. So there is some degree of rational, basis to the fear. I think the other way that the Eritrean government manages to keep an eye on the diaspora and to keep a degree of control on the diaspora is through what they call the 2% tax. So this is a tax that if you're an Eritrean living outside of Eritrea, for example, you need to go to the embassy and get a document for some reason. And if you haven't paid your 2% tax, you may not get that document. And there may be other problems.
So though you're living in Canada or Europe or the United States, you have to pay a 2% tax of your earnings back to the Eritrean government?
if you need to have any kind of official paper, I mean, for many refugees, of course, the situation is different because they're seeking asylum, they're refugees, they have no plans to return to Eritrea. But many of those people are extraordinarily afraid of being identified, for instance, because they're afraid there will be repercussions for their family members back home if it's known that they've fled the country. Because the attitude of the Eritrean government to people, to Eritreans who flee illegally, if they don't get, say, their exit documents, their exit permission, then they're seen as traitors, that they've fled illegally, they've passed over the border, snuck out of the country, and then their family, there are cases where their family members have then suffered repercussions in Eritrea, either heavy fines, sometimes arrests, sometimes having their property confiscated. So there is a real fear that their families will face reprisals.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at the repressive African nation of Eritrea and how journalists and people there are surviving under a harsh dictator. Our guest this week from Amsterdam in the Netherlands, Leslie Lefkow, the Deputy Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. From Nairobi, Tom Rhodes, the East Africa Representative for the Committee to Protect Journalists. And from Iowa City, Iowa, Ron McMullen, the former U.S. Ambassador to Eritrea from 2007 to 2010. Tom Rhodes, we just heard Leslie Lefkow talking about sort of the reach of the Eritrean intelligence service overseas. You're in Kenya. Do you see that Eritreans or Eritrean exiled journalists in Kenya are actually affected by this? Is that, do you sense that fear is real?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I keep in a very sort of secure way communication with many exiled Eritrean journalists. Kenya itself is not the worst one, and I don't think we've had many cases of surveillance or entrapment here in Nairobi, for example. But Sudan and Uganda are sort of two areas that I've noticed a lot of activity of the Eritrean security forces, and the exiled journalists are understandably very worried by their presence.
In Uganda, in Sudan, if you're in exile, you may sense the actual presence of the Eritrean service watching.
Absolutely. I mean, especially Khartoum, because that's obviously the natural place where many Eritreans flee to, being a bordering country. And, there's a heavy presence of exiled Eritreans there. It used to be a haven a long time ago when Eritrea and Sudan had poor political relations. But unfortunately for Eritreans in exile, the relations have normalized. And now Khartoum is working hand in hand with the Eritrean authorities to target those in exile.
And Ambassador McMullen, you heard Tom Rhodes talking about Eritrea's relationship with Sudan. Talk to us just a little bit about its relations with its other neighbors in the region there, particularly Somalia.
Eritrea and Somalia have had a long history of close cooperation, both former Italian colonies. Somalia provided military training and supplies to the Eritrean guerrillas fighting Ethiopia, whom Somalia had invaded in the Ogaden War of 1977. Isaias sees as his existential threat Ethiopia, which is 20 times larger than Eritrea. And as a result of Eritrea's independence, Ethiopia is now landlocked. So Eritrea has had long and good relations with Somalia. In 2006, when Ethiopia invaded Somalia, much of the leadership of the Islamist Court Union, fled from Mogadishu to Asmara.
So these were the Islamists who were in control of Mogadishu then?
Right. And I met with quite a number of them, and as did others from my embassy, to try to convince them to join something called the Djibouti process to establish a broad-based government. Some did, and moved from Asmara to Djibouti and then back to Mogadishu to participate in a transitional federal government of Somalia. But a hardcore group of Islamists stayed in Asmara and eventually formed something called Hezbollah Islam, which returned to Somalia and joined the fight alongside al-Shabaab, which has recruited, several dozen Minnesotans into its ranks. Some of those Minnesotans have carried out terrorist attacks in the region. U.S. Law enforcement and intelligence officers are concerned about.
But wait, I'm just a little bit confused here, because Eritrea, it's partly a Muslim country, partly Christian, and yet here its government, which is Christian-dominated, is supporting radical Islamic groups in Somalia.
Yeah, that's because they see as their the key to their strategic plan to defeat Ethiopia is to dismember Ethiopia by first having an anti-Addis Ababa organization in Somalia help break off the Ogaden, the Somali-populated part of Ethiopia. Eritrea supports the Oromo Liberation Front, which is based in Eritrea, which is the next ethnic group that lives further north. And they see Ethiopia as the descendants of sort of the modern-day Abyssinian Empire, full of people seething to break away from Addis Ababa.
So in other words, you know, the hot conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea ended 15 years ago, but it sounds like Eritrea is still supporting rebel groups then who basically are wanting to gain independence or attack Ethiopia then. Is that fair to say?
And correct. And Ethiopia supports a number of Eritrean dissident groups that sometimes raid across the border in small unit forays. So there's this constant back and forth. And Eritrea sees itself in a no peace, no war situation, which is one reason it uses to justify its open-ended national service.
Well, let me just turn this to Leslie Lefkow. Then we've heard a fair bit about the human rights concerns in Eritrea, as well as sort of the problems with some of its neighbors. What do you see happen going forward? Is there cause for hope that things will get better there for its people and for people in the region?
I would like to think so, but I don't think we see a lot of opening for the kind of reforms that are needed to put Eritrea on a different track. You know, there's promises that are made by President Isaias and other senior level officials, but we haven't actually seen any of those promises, bearing fruit. And I think that, you know, we're talking about really major reforms, I think, that need to be pursued on the human rights front, but also on the economic front, on the political front. And I think one of the saddest things about the situation in Eritrea is when you speak to Eritreans, particularly older people who lived through, the long war of independence, they are, as Ambassador McMullen said, so proud of their country. And so sad to leave. When you speak to people, even, you know, people who were fighters in the military, and they hate to leave their country. I mean, they don't want to leave, but they're leaving because they feel there's no hope of change. And I think that's really the tragedy of Eritrea.
Well, let me get you, Tom Rhodes, with just about 20 seconds left, a rather dim view from Leslie Lefkow on the future. How do you see things?
Yeah, unfortunately, I have to chime in with what Leslie just said. I mean, I don't see any positive days forward for the Eritrean press. We're still seeing state journalists from Dimtse Hafash and others fleeing the country on a monthly basis. But, you know, my only hope is that we're seeing more and more kind of cracks within the system and more efforts from a more organized exiled Eritrean population to provide a different media source for the public.
Thanks very much to Leslie Lefkow, Ron McMullen, Tom Rhodes for joining us. Global Journalist Executive Producer is Joshua Kranzberg. Our associate producers this week are Inez Gaviria and Nassim Benjabani. Our studio director is Travis McMillan from RJI. Our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBIA. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.